This is a Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report special. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. On today's program, we'll explore some of the ways that Dr. Martin Luther King built bridges from the Civil Rights Movement to other social movements, uniting the protest movements for social change in the late 1960s. As the decade progressed, the war in Vietnam grew in intensity, as did the movement against it. In 1967, Dr. King came out in opposition to the war and delivered his famous speech at the Riverside Church on April 4th of that year, thus joining the massive protest movement against the war. While the AFL-CIO's President George Meany actively supported the war, a number of labor unions came out against the war at a Labor Leadership Assembly for Peace in Chicago in November 1967. We now hear Dr. King's speech at that event introduced by Cleveland Robinson, Secretary-Treasurer of District 65, which was based in New York City.
Like Dr. King, 65ers have always been unalterably opposed to the war in Vietnam. On November 11th, 1967, leaders of 65, along with hundreds of other trade union leaders, at a Chicago Labor Conference for Peace, heard from Dr. King on the war in Vietnam.
Mr. Chairman and distinguished dais guests, my brothers and sisters of the labor movement, ladies and gentlemen, I need not pause to say how very delighted I am to be here this afternoon and to be some little part of this extremely significant assembly. And I certainly want to commend the persons who have worked so assiduously to make this conference possible, for it is my deep conviction that it will have tremendous meaning and impact in the days to come. I don't feel that I come among strangers today, for I feel that I'm an honorary member of many labor unions all across the country. In fact, I think Cleve Robinson and Dave Livingston of District 65 in New York made me an honorary member a long time ago, and I've been a 65er a long time. But in all seriousness, I'm delighted to be here, and I want to get right into the message, and I want to try to talk very honestly and frankly about this great problem, this great issue that we face as a result of the war in Vietnam. Some of my words may appear to be rather harsh, but they will be as harsh as truth and as gentle as a nonviolent devotee would be. And I want to use as a subject the domestic impact of the war in America. This question is historic because it is an authentic expression of the conscience of the labor movement. As has been said already this afternoon, tens of millions of Americans oppose the war in Vietnam. Never in our history has there been such a passionate popular resistance to a current war. In addition to the millions upon millions of ordinary people, eminent scholars, distinguished senators, journalists, businessmen, professionals, students, and political leaders at all levels have protested the war and offered alternatives with an amazing tenacity and boldness. But one voice was missing, the loud, clear voice of labor. The absence of that one voice was all the more tragic because it may be the decisive one for tipping the balance toward peace. Labor has been missing. For too long, the moral appeal has been flickering, not shining as it did in its dynamic days of growth. This conference, a united expression of varied branches of labor, reaffirms that the trade union movement is part of forward-looking America. That no matter what the formal resolutions of higher bodies may be, the troubled conscience of the working people cannot be stilled. This conference speaks for millions. And you here today will long be remembered as those who had the courage to speak out and the wisdom to be right. It is noteworthy that the Labour Party of Great Britain, which of course has no responsibility for our actions, nonetheless went on record on October 4th in a formal national resolution calling upon its labor government to dissociate itself completely from U.S. policy in Vietnam. It urged its government to persuade the United States to end the bombing of North Vietnam immediately, permanently, and unconditionally. Now, what are some of the domestic consequences of the war in Vietnam? It has made the Great Society a myth and replaced it with the troubled and confused society. The war has strengthened domestic reaction. It has given the extreme right, the anti-labor, anti-Negro, and anti-humanistic forces a weapon of spurious patriotism to galvanize its supporters into reaching for power right up to the White House. It hopes to use national frustration to take control and restore the America of social insecurity and power for the privileged. When a Hollywood performer, lacking distinction even as an actor, can become a leading war hawk candidate for the presidency, only the irrationalities induced by a war psychosis can explain such a melancholy turn of events. The war in Vietnam has produced a shameful order of priorities in which the decay, squalor, and pollution of the cities are neglected, and even though 70% of our population now live in them. The war has smothered and nearly extinguished the beginnings of progress toward racial justice. The war has created the bizarre spectacle of armed forces of the United States fighting in ghetto streets in America while they are fighting in jungles in Asia. The war has so increased Negro frustration and despair that urban outbreaks are now an ugly feature of the American scene. How can the administration, with quivering anger, denounce the violence of ghetto Negroes when it has given an example of violence in Asia that shocks the world? The users of naval guns, millions of tons of bombs, and revolting napalm cannot speak to Negroes about violence. Only those who are fighting for peace have the moral authority to lecture on nonviolence. Now, I do not want to be misunderstood. I am not equating the so-called Negro violence with the war. The acts of Negroes are infinitely less dangerous and immoral than the deliberate acts of escalation of the war in Vietnam. In fact, the Negroes in the ghetto, goaded and angered by discrimination and neglect, have for the most part deliberately avoided harming persons. They have destroyed property, but even in the grip of rage, the vast majority have vented their anger on inanimate things, not people. When I first decided to take a firm stand against the war in Vietnam, I was subjected to the most bitter criticism by the press, by individuals, and even by some fellow civil rights leaders. There were those who said that I should stay in my place, that I was a civil rights leader, and that these two issues did not mix, and I should stick with civil rights. Well, I had only one answer for that, and it was simply the fact that I have struggled too long and too hard now to get rid of segregation in public accommodations to end up at this point in my life segregating my moral concern. And I made it very clear that I recognize that justice was indivisible. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And then there were those who said, you're hurting the civil rights movement, and one spoke to me one day and said, now, Dr. King, don't you think you're going to have to agree more with the administration's policy? I understand that your position on Vietnam has hurt the budget of your organization. And many people who respected you in civil rights have lost that respect. And don't you think that you are going to have to agree more with administration's policy to regain this? And I had to answer by looking that person into the eye and say, I'm sorry, sir, but you don't know me. I'm not a consensus leader. I do not determine what is right and wrong by looking at the budget of my organization or by taking a Gallup poll of the majority opinion. Ultimately, a genuine leader is not a sucher for consensus, but a molder of consensus. On some positions, cowardice asks the question, is it safe? Expediency asks the question, is it politic? Vanity asks the question, is it popular? But conscience asks the question, is it right? And there comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe, nor politic, nor popular, but he must take it because conscience tells him it is right.
Although Dr. King always appreciated the need for involvement of unions in the movement for civil rights, it was not till the later part of the 1960s that the movement for economic rights became central to his vision of the struggle for social change. By 1968, he had moved his headquarters to Chicago and was immersed in organizing a Poor People's March to Washington, D.C. When the Nashville sanitation workers went on strike, he joined them for his last battle.
It was at Memphis that King fought his last battle for the black sanitation workers. We talked with Taylor Rogers, who was an active rank-and-file member of the union during that struggle and later, for 20 years, became the president of the local. What was your salary in those days?
Oh, about $1.40 an hour.
And did you have any vacation time?
No.
What about sick leave?
No sick leave.
And a grievance procedure?
No grievance procedure.
How were the work assignments of the white sanitation workers different than those of the black workers?
Well, they didn't have any white sanitation workers. The whites was heavy equipment operators.
And what kind of assignments did they do?
Well, their assignment was, whatever. You know, they dealt with the bulldozers and those big cranes and things. You know, it was a whole different ball game for them because on rainy days they still got paid. They would come in and just be there and they would get paid, but they would send us back home and we didn't get any pay.
When you actually went on strike, and this is a strike that was the last 68 days, how was your family affected?
Well, they really wasn't because of the community and the leadership and the churches and everybody that came together to help those strikers. And, they provided food for us and we helped pay our bills and all this kind of stuff.
Was your safety, was your personal safety ever in question during the strike?
Well, sometimes, you would get threats, nigger, go back to work, and this kind of thing.
How did you pick up the support of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.?
Well, through Reverend Lawson, one of the ministers here in Memphis, he contacted Dr. King. That was Dr. King's thing, was to help poor people on the bottom of the ladder. And he contacted Dr. King, and he came in. At that time, he was planning for the Poor People's March. He just put everything aside to come in and work with the sanitation workers.
Why do you think it was important to pick up the support of Martin Luther King?
Well, because of his leadership. And people had faith and confidence in him. And it mobilized the men, that the ones that had begun to start to go back to work. When he got involved, that mobilized the men, and all those men that had went back come back out. And, that helped mobilize this whole thing.
What did the struggle for civil rights and the struggle for workers' rights have in common? What joined the two together then?
I really can't say, but let me try to put it this way. Because it's all the same thing, they were saying our strike was illegal, but all they were saying, segregation and this kind of thing, all it means is a man is not a man. Whatever you say, however you put it, when it comes down to that, it's just, a man is not a man, and he don't have anything to say about his hours and working conditions. Yeah.
Wasn't there an injunction that was prohibiting the workers from marching at that time when Martin Luther King came down?
No, it wasn't. But at one time before, we had we had put our picket lines to strike. We had to call those pickets back in because of the injunction. The injunction came about after the first march that was violent. And Dr. King was determined to come back to Memphis to have a nonviolent march. And that's when they was talking about this injunction. The only injunction that we had about going back to work was on the first time that we came out to try to get recognition. And then we had to go back in with that injunction. But the second injunction that they were talking about an injunction to keep from having this second march.
How did the terrible tragedy of the assassination of Martin Luther King on April 4th affect the strikers?
Well, you know, the strikers were sad, but I think that the cause of his death was the cause of the nation getting behind Henry Loeb and making him move off his stand that we couldn't organize.
How did the settlement of the sanitation strike affect the workers and also other workers in the municipal government? Did they organize because of it?
Yes. Yes, they did, yes. And you know, we got benefits. I can't just spell out the specifics of it, but I just can't remember that far back. But anyway, we had a decent settlement.
And what about the municipal workers, other municipal workers?
Well, at that time, it was just 1,300 sanitation workers that went out. But right after the strike, and after we got recognition, then we organized the school board, the city hospital, the park commission, and all other municipalities.
What do you think that the union movement has done for black workers?
It has done wonderful things. We moved up. We got good wages, we got good benefits, and, you know, it always can be better. But we do have good wages and good benefits at this time.
We actually are speaking to you on the national holiday of Martin Luther King's birth.
Right.
In reminiscence, is there anything that particularly occurred to you today?
Well, you know, from Dr. King's way of doing things, you can always remember that he was for poor people. He was trying to upgrade poor people. And, you know, that was just the kind of a person that he was.
Well, we'd like to thank you very much for being with us. We've been speaking with Taylor Rogers, former president of the Memphis Sanitation Workers and striker in those very early days for recognition of the rights of African-American workers in Memphis. Thank you.
And now a selection from Dr. King addressing an audience of Memphis sanitation workers during the strike.
All labor has dignity. But you are doing another thing. You are reminding not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages. We built gigantic buildings to kiss the sky. We built gargantuan bridges to span the seas. Through our spaceships, we were able to carve highways through the stratosphere. Through our airplanes, we were able to dwarf distance and place time in chains. Through our submarines, we were able to penetrate oceanic depths. It seems that I can hear the God of the universe saying, even though you've done all of that, I was hungry and you fed me not. I tell you what you ought to do, and you're together here enough to do it. in a few days you ought to get together and just have a general work stoppage in the city of Memphis. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right. And so just as I say, we aren't going to let any dogs or water hoses turn us around. We aren't going to let any injunction turn us around. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
You've been listening to Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report, produced and hosted by Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Building Bridges is broadcast live on Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time over WBAI in New York City. You can go to the WBAI website, www.wbai.org, to hear the live stream.